Welcome to Parents Perspective. Get down! Yelled Meg to 10-year-old Mark, who was perched precariously on a stone wall overlooking a scenic river gorge. Don't you see how far you could fall if you lost your balance? Ah, Mom, he grumbled, climbing down as slowly as humanly possible. Don't get so stressed. I was fine up there. I wasn't going to fall. Why don't you relax, read your book or something? He turned to his 8-year-old brother, who was busily collecting pebbles, and motioned to a cliff about 50 yards away. Hey, Tommy, want to see who can make it to the top first? Bet I can beat you. From a parent's perspective, what should we know and what can we do about children's risk-taking? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today, we are lucky to have a husband and wife team to advise us on coping with kids' risk-taking behavior. Dr. Margot Richters is a clinical psychologist at the Reginald Lurie Center. Dr. John Richters is a research psychologist on developmental psychopathology and works with the National Institute of Nursing Research. Together, they have 2 daughters, ages 4 and 7. Welcome to Parents Perspective.
I'm glad to be here.
Hi, thanks for having us.
As parents, we all have different thresholds for what we'd call a kid's risky behavior. How would you define risk-taking in children?
There is no definition of risk-taking carved in marble because it is all so culture-specific, both in the general sense and in the local parenting sense. There are many things we can all agree on are beyond the pale in terms of risk-taking behavior, but most of the things that parents are concerned about fall in a relatively gray area, or certainly many of them, that are in some subcultures perfectly accepted and, in fact, expected, and in other cases, there are deliberate structural institutional sanctions against them. So there is no single definition, though, that's going to fit for all parents. Would you agree with that, Margot?
I would. Of course, there's
Dr.
certain
things.
But, of course, there are certain things we could all agree on, like skydiving and bungee jumping. You know, anything that probably makes your hair stand up on the back of your neck is probably risk-taking behavior.
There are risks associated with everything that we do, beginning with getting up in the morning, leaving the house, surrounding ourselves in these steel containers, going down the highway at 60 miles an hour and greater, within just a few feet of objects coming at the same speed in the other direction, and we don't think much about it at all. And in some cultures, it would be considered absurd that human beings would put themselves in that kind of danger on a regular basis. So there are many things that parents are concerned about, that ranges of behavior that their children engage in or are tempted to engage in and that they feel uncomfortable about but aren't quite sure whether to simply try to pull the reins in on the child or be somewhat permissive and try to supervise them and coach them, or just kind of shield them from all of it and keep them away from the possibility that they're going to be involved in those things.
It's hard letting go. Try new things.
Is there a kind of profile of a risk-taking kid, or do most kids have tendencies in that direction?
In thinking about risk-taking, there are certainly temperamental differences related to risk-taking that are apparent from the moment of birth. But certainly the risk-taking behavior isn't apparent from the moment of birth, but the temperamental characteristics are often easily observable early on. And they tend to manifest themselves in terms of fearlessness, unusual openness to novel experiences. But it's much later on that we begin to associate those things with the kind of risk-taking behaviors that we're concerned about. Some people have a naturally low threshold. They can be born with a naturally low threshold for novel situations, novel experiences, experiences that involve some degree of risk. And other people have an extremely high threshold for that and would easily engage in behaviors that the other children wouldn't consider. Now, you can be born with those general tendencies that are deeply seated in your basic personality from birth and play themselves out in different ways across the lifespan. And this is one of the ways that they play themselves out. Or you can acquire that kind of orientation. That is to say, you can be born with a relatively low threshold for thrill-seeking, for risk-taking behavior, which is to say that you will engage in these behaviors quite readily, or you can be born without that tendency but encouraged and shaped into that behavior pattern by the kind of local reinforcement structure that surrounds you. This is especially true of boys. There's a strong tendency for boys to be engaging in more risk-taking behavior than girls on average, although there's tremendous overlap between them. And there are certain kinds of risk-taking that are expected by the male culture, and if you don't engage in those things, you're not considered as well by your peers.
And what kind of risk-taking are you thinking of?
Well, I wasn't going to address a specific risk-taking, but I was actually going to say in a lot of cultures, there is an actual rite of passage that young males and young females go through, and they tend to be high-risk things to prove your manhood or your womanhood. Now, in our country, we've sort of done away with ritualized rites of passage that we do as a culture.
Except driving. It's pretty
risky. She has a 16-year-old with a new license.
Kids, and especially adolescents, still feel this need to kind of make that rite of passage. So they will often create cultures for themselves, such as hazing going if in college is the same kind of rite of passage to show your manhood or your womanhood to get into the fraternity or the sorority. So there are ways the kids have that need, have that feeling of wanting to prove themselves, and so they will often find their own ways and their own communities to help them do that. And it would be something if we made driving more of a celebration afterwards, after you pass and get your license and prove you can do it, maybe that would help.
Give out aspirins to parents
around. Absolutely. Right. And there are some numbers that are relevant to this, dead on relevant, and that is that across national boundaries, going back more than 100 years where data are available from different societies, it is the case that the vast majority of children, by the time they reach adolescence, by the time they make it through adolescence, have committed at least one, what in this country would be considered a arrestable offense, which is to say that a certain amount of risk-taking and acting out behavior may in fact be normal. It be a normal part of the developmental trajectory, which helps children, adolescents, learn what the boundaries are of behavior that they're comfortable with, learn about themselves, learn about the world, and what the vast majority of children prior to adolescence are perfectly fine. They're not engaging in these risky behaviors. And when they survive adolescence, after adolescence, they return to their normal range behavior for them. But during adolescence, especially during adolescence, the vast majority of kids will engage in a certain degree of normative and normal acting out behavior, including much of it considered risk-taking by adults.
Can you give some examples? I'm thinking of Grand Theft Auto or something.
No, don't forget, in this society, there are status offenses as well. Running away, being beyond the control of your parents, engaging in physical aggression in school, both physical aggression and verbal aggression. The physical aggression traditionally is much less common with girls than with boys. So there, shoplifting, for some kids, I mean, there are a whole range of behaviors that we don't consider, in the cold light of day, we don't consider them horrible things, but we do if our children are engaging in them. But they're experimental behaviors for a lot of kids from which they learn. Sometimes on the first act, they learn that they don't want to do it again, not because they're afraid to get caught, but because they feel guilty about what they have done, so which is an important lesson that they can't learn in any other way. So that's, which is not to encourage children to do those things, but that's often how they learn.
It's interesting. We had some people on a show not too long ago talking about personal integrity, mm-hmm. and that seems like that's fitting in here very well.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on risk-taking.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Margot Richters and Dr. John Richters about risk-taking and kids.
You speak of teenagers, and of course we all shudder as our children approach their teens and we get through that period of time. Are there other times we should be alert for maybe earlier stages in our children's development when we should also be alert for more risk-taking behavior than we had seen earlier?
I was going to say one thing about that. The at very young ages, when John was talking about some of the temperament things, there seems to be a sort of a subset of young children who not just have this fearlessness, but don't seem to notice when they're engaging mm-hmm. in dangerous behavior. May not have that great sense of their own body integrity, where they are in space, bump into people. May try to climb something that they don't realize is going to tip over because they just don't seem to have sort of this internal...
A kinesthetic kind of
thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a son who was, I think, 10 or 11 at the time that he decided his risky behavior was going to be sticking his foot out when the elevator door closed. Whoa. That was risky for him because he wasn't totally sure where his body was in space, and that was it.
Well, and so these are children that sometimes, you know, occupational therapy can help children like that to help them get a sense of their bodies in space and how things work. And also kids when they're, you know, there's a reason we don't have kids go to first grade until they're 6 or 7 years old, because there's certain processes in your brain that you can't do yet. You can't do certain kinds of math yet. Cause and effect is something you learn how to understand what effects. So sticking your foot in the elevator door, you can't think through beyond that looks like a fun thing to do, but if the door is shut, that might hurt my foot. Parents of younger children can help them understand what the natural consequences are of things because they can't necessarily think through.
What can parents do to lower the chances of a child's being lured into risky behavior by peers? You were mentioning shoplifting and some of that kind of stuff, and we all think, you know, there's a whole bunch of kids, and they'll say, hey, I dare you. I bet you can do it.
Well, I remember parents who wouldn't let their kids go to the mall when my kids were in middle school and mm-hmm. high school. There were parents who said, well, I won't let them go to the mall unless one of the parents is with them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think two important things, supervision and information. You have to give children information. It's the same thing of thinking through the consequences to help them understand if you do this, these are the things that could happen, and also giving them coping strategies, social skills, which not all children have naturally, so that you can play out scenarios if someone says, let's go do this wild thing. And a lot of kids aren't naturally going to want to do that, but also don't want to say no.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? What do you say to them? And you can help them think through, what will I do when my friends invite me to things I may not want to do?
That's okay. A tremendous strategy for parents to employ, is to anticipate these things and to have the dangers and to develop a dialogue with their children. And beginning at a very early ages, even 3 and 4 years old, what would they do if they were being kind of cajoled by their friends to do this and this wasn't wrong? How would they handle it? And along those lines, it is an underappreciated strategy of parenting, I think, to discourage the exclusive friendship of one or two people. There's a tendency for kids to band together into small cliques at very early in the school years. The more different friends that a child has or an adolescent, the less likely that child is to be influenced negatively, to be kind of subject to the influences of one or two people. But if you've got all of your friendships invested, all of your connections with other kids invested in one or two people, and those one or two people are encouraging you to do something that is very risky or illegal, then you're obviously going to be subject to much more, you're going to feel that pressure much more, and you're going to feel much more obligated to go ahead and do it without thinking about it than if you have a broader array of friends and to think about and to turn your attention to be influenced by.
That's a really good thought. I'm not sure. Yeah. I think you're right. It is underappreciated.
Mm-hmm.
If risk-taking is a genuine part of a child's personality, how do we curb the natural tendencies when we have to without damaging self-esteem in the process?
I would say that it's number one to think about this is not to think about, we're talking about a risk-taking tendency, but not to think about it as an inherently negative or positive thing. It's a neutral characteristic of a child's personality, and if properly managed, can be channeled to great ends. And it doesn't necessarily have to be something to, the natural tendency for a parent is to try to dampen it, to keep it on a short leash, make it go away. But that's number one, unrealistic for many kids. I mean, depending on the child's particulars and the circumstances and the child's history, it may be virtually impossible and certainly counterproductive. But to rechannel that energy and find there are sports that are extremely well suited to kids with certain kinds of impulsive characteristics. There are occupations in which that serves one well later on. It's not only unrealistic, probably not good for the child or the adolescent to be trying to dampen and make it go away.
I guess we should also say here that we're not necessarily talking about physical risk-taking.
Right.
We could talk about creative risk-taking in terms of people who've made scientific discoveries, people who are artistic, or that kind of thing. Those are also risk-taking behaviors.
Absolutely. The founders of this country, I mean, most of the people that we look to and admire in this country are risk-takers. And that's how this country was formed, and that's where most of the major accomplishments in business and industry and science come from are not the people who are following the herd, but the people who are willing to, for whatever reasons, to take a certain amount of risk and to not listen to people who tell them it can't be done or there are certain risks associated with it, but to keep their eyes on the horizon.
One of the things I would add to that is, you know, we often catch kids in the act of doing something we think is bad instead of catching them in the act of doing something good. So if you have someone who's slams the door 9 times out of 10, we yell at them 9 times. Instead of the one time they do the good thing, you say, hey, you shut the door the right way. So if someone's showing sort of divergent, out-of-the-box kind of thinking, which we also can call risk-taking kind of thinking, when they do something that is incredible, so the graffiti that is a beautiful drawing that they've done with the spray can, you say, that's amazing. Let's get it on a canvas.
So that they instead of still on, get
and
to
off
do
the wall.
Right.
Exactly. Right.
Instead of on your police record.
Right. Or nice cutting, be a surgeon.
When we see so much negative kinds of risk-taking and thrill-seeking on movies and on TV, how can parents ameliorate that influence on our kids?
Some of it, I think, depends on the age of the children. I mean, with younger children, they're watching Spider-Man, and can I jump from a roof to a roof like that? You have to help with younger children understand the difference between reality and fantasy. And that requires a parent to be in the room when they're watching whatever it is they're watching and explaining, is that real? And the kid, I'm not sure, you know. No, that's not real. That's fantasy. That's make-believe. Certain things like that. And supervision in terms of talking to children about what they're seeing and watching, how it makes them feel, what that's about.
I absolutely agree. And to kind of being available for debriefing. And even though children especially, and there are certain ages, of course, where this resistance to parenting advice and so forth peaks, and it peaks for a long period during adolescence, but even when adolescents are resistant to any kind of input at all from their parents, they still listen. They still hear. And they won't let you, they won't give you the benefit of acknowledging that what you said may be worthy of consideration, but it often is, and it does sink in. So it's a long way of saying that parents should not let any kind of negative feedback from their adolescents about their attempts to control or intervene or offer advice distract them from their job, which is to be there and to point out things that their children need to know, and to not expect to get positive reinforcement from that. But it will get through.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on risk-taking.
For an audio cassette copy of any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parent's Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking today with Dr. Margot Richters and Dr. John Richters about risk-taking.
I would say a good way to open a dialogue with adolescents and younger children is instead of giving your feeling or your reaction to something they're saying, oh, I don't like when you watch that, or that scares me to see that, you say, man, what was that like for you to watch? And just listen. You will also see it more in adolescents and some younger kids when there's some depression going on. That sort of acting out behavior, because depression in children and adolescents also often expresses itself as anger. And anger can translate quickly into doing dangerous behaviors, because it's kind of a way to let people know, I'm mad, look at me, help me.
So what should parents be looking for in that case?
Well, with depression, it's probably some of the classic things you've heard of. They seem to change friends, or they seem withdrawn, and they're not doing things with friends hardly at all. They're in their room a lot, keeping to themselves a lot, which is a lot what, I guess, adolescents do anyway.
That's the hard part with adolescents.
They disappear for a number of years.
But depression tends to really announce itself.
That's right. It's the kind of judgment that is best left to a parent, because the parents know the context, they know the child's history, and they know what is kind of baseline for the child. But we've been talking so far about risk-taking behavior and what should parents look out for, and how might they try to influence their children who are exposed to these various possibilities of risk-taking behavior. But some children are motivated to be risk-takers precisely because it's dangerous, precisely because it'll get them the attention that they otherwise don't get or don't feel that they get. And those children need to be identified and responded to very differently than children for whom you can make the reasonable assumption that they don't realize how dangerous this is. They don't realize that there are alternatives. But if you're dealing with a child that's motivated to do these things, or if a child who doesn't have, realistically, from that child's standpoint, reasonable alternatives, it's not going to do much good to be trying to use these other strategies, trying to encourage them to stay away from that. There is a tendency to look for easy answers to these questions, and there aren't any. If there were, we wouldn't be sitting here.
But I would also say often, you know, parents will say, oh, she's just doing that for attention. Yes. So give it to them.
In other ways.
Kids want attention. If they're seeking attention, there's a reason they're seeking attention, and it's probably that they need it. So you can give it to them.
But not for the not necessarily.
But not necessarily for the bad behavior. But if that's what they're doing. And, you know, we have a lot of parents. Everyone's working and people are busy, and you may not know all the things you really ought to be knowing about your children, and you may need to just stop a minute and find out a little bit more about your child, who their friends are, what's going on in school, what's happening at the soccer game, or find out more about what's going on so that they feel like you're more engaged, more involved.
Sounds like really taking some time.
I think it's important. Because for them to know that you care is extremely important. You can never care enough.
And they do their math real well, at least in that respect. Kids know the difference between a parent who is busy and a parent who is disengaged, regardless of whether or not that parent is busy. And that attentiveness to the child and that kind of interest in what the child is doing and so forth is something that penetrates and that has a tremendous meaning and signal value to kids, and is really is probably the single most important source of leverage a parent has in shaping the child's behavior and protecting them from things that they need to be protected from.
Well, speaking of risk-taking behaviors, as kids get older, I assume that it gets much more dangerous.
Right, absolutely. A little boy can't steal a car until his legs are long enough to reach the pedals. And the same is true with girls. There's more sexual behavior you would see as they get into adolescence, taking the risk of unprotected sex, whether that opens you up to STDs and AIDS or the risk of getting pregnant.
STDs are sexually transmitted diseases.
Right. And, of course, boys can get those things, too. But I think for girls, the risk for them are so much greater in terms of getting pregnant. You have to have faith that the values you've been instilling for a long time are going to end up coming out in the end, and that, you know, giving children respect and responsibility, which, you know, part of our society now, too, is that you don't really get to have a job till you're all the way out of college for some kids. And after high school, in other cultures, 13-year-olds are given incredible amounts of responsibility for the welfare of their culture. And we delay it and delay it and delay it. And that gives our adolescents a really hard time understanding where they fit in.
Someone once said, a very wise parent said, that a kid needs to go to bed knowing that he or she made a difference in that day.
Absolutely. I like that.
Well, I do too. I think we all do.
That's true.
But we often forget that it's a need that develops very early. Although it's not articulated very early, it's always there.
Do you have some resources you could suggest for parents besides stunt training?
There's a tremendous amount of information and links and resources available on the World Wide Web, of course. An organization that is particularly good at working with children of all ages is kidspeace.org. This is a tremendous organization, and if you sign onto their website, you can participate anonymously or by giving them identifying information for the next time you sign on, and you can find your way to areas, chat rooms and so forth, where you can discuss particular problems. You can look at the archive files of kids who have shared information about problems they've had in certain domains, how they've handled them. So it's a tremendous resource, and it's widely used now. And they do a lot of concentrated advertising in major cities, but somehow children, adolescents often don't hear of it. So I would urge that as probably one of the single best sources to turn to.
Kids Peace?
Because it's kidspeace.org.
Also, doesn't it have a site where kids can sign on themselves and talk to counselors or other kids
and
that kind of thing?
And there are links out to other sites as well.
There's also the National Parent Information Network, which is, I guess it's npin.org is their website. And that's a part of the Eric Clearinghouse, which is on a whole array of mostly early childhood, but it has links to older children.
Eric spelled E-R-I-C?
E-R-I-C.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
This is a real person now, not a web address. A tremendous resource for parents, especially of young children, is the school bus driver.
Yeah.
The school bus drivers know more about your children than your neighbors do because of what they hear, and on a day-to-day basis, they get the lay of the land on what's going on among the kids generally. And for the kids that are riding on their bus every day, they get to know much more about them than we give them credit for. So I wouldn't necessarily pick their brain for advice on how to handle problems, but they can be a great source of information about what's going on. It's also extremely useful to be in touch with parents of other kids. A lot of parents would be surprised and relieved to learn about how much of what they're experiencing other parents are experiencing, and to learn how the other parents are dealing with it.
It's a very good reality check, isn't it?
It's a great reality check.
Both of you have been wonderful reality checks and magnificent resources for both of us and for all of our listeners. So, Dr. Margot Richters and Dr. John Richters, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here. We're going to go home and do some parenting now.
Great idea.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Parents as Mentors. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 151. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective and our books Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.